Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Post-Election Roundtable. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. And to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Thank you. I'll now turn the conference over to Ms. Carol Gregory. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Carol Gregory. I'm the Vice President of Communications at Conservation Law Foundation, and I want to first thank all of you who have joined us by phone or on Facebook, and we're here to break down what I think might be one of the most watched midterm elections that I can remember, and joining us for that conversation to break down what happened last night and what it all means for the work we're doing here in New England is President of Conservation Law Foundation, Brad Campbell. Jamie Hoyt, who is the former Secretary of Environmental Affairs in Massachusetts, and Emily Green, who is a staff attorney and a legal advocate in our main office. So I'd like to hear from all of you just your gut reaction on what happened last night. What were the big takeaways from the midterm elections, both nationally and in New England?
Well, I'd call it a split decision. I think on the good news side, we have a real cementing of the coalition of elected officials who care about climate and want to act and who are otherwise pro-environment. So you have Ned Lamont in Connecticut, who is committed to making Connecticut carbon neutral by 2050. You've got Governor Raimondo in Rhode Island being reelected. You've got, after years of climate denying, Governor LePage in Maine, who have a governor committed to renewable energy. And that's true really up and down the East Coast, and it's bipartisan. Governor Scott reelected, also a Republican governor who joined the Climate Coalition. Charlie Baker here in Massachusetts, although you know, tepid in his support among environmental groups, has begun to act and certainly has moved significantly from where he started on those issues. And they're really reinforced, and were reinforced last night by the election of the AGs in various states who've been pushed back hard on the Trump anti-environmental agenda and have pushed hard on accountability for companies like ExxonMobil, who CLF is suing. So Maura Healey in Massachusetts, the new Letitia James in New York, Javier Becerra in California. That coalition of AGs is enormously important to holding the line on environment. On the negative side, and one other plus for New England, which is the leadership positions we've captured. Jim McGovern as head of the Rules Committee, which decides every bill and every amendment that gets to go to the House floor. Ricky Neal in the House, who's going to chair Ways and Means, very powerful positions. Those are really going, I think, to empower New England in many ways. On the negative side, we have it's a relatively narrow margin in the House to stop Trump. Some of those new members, new Democrats, are fairly moderate and might be peeled off for parts of the Trump agenda. And there are a number of environmental ballot initiatives, most notably carbon fee initiatives in the state of Washington, the state of Colorado, that went down to defeat. And there were other environmental ballot initiatives across the country that that were defeated. One bright spot is a water pollution infrastructure bill. Funding bill was approved in Rhode Island. But I think people have to be careful about the narrative to take away from that. I think it was really more about those defeats were more about the amount of money the oil and gas industry poured into defeating climate initiatives rather than necessarily the merits of the policies themselves.
You know, I would, in broad terms, agree with your assessment, Brad. I do think that we might put some emphasis, if you will, on the positive. And, you know, you articulated that right. But in a place like Massachusetts, for example, where we have Charlie Baker, and I certainly would agree that he hasn't been as aggressive on climate as we want him to be. But at the same time, it seems to me that he's someone who is trying to solidify his bipartisan credentials, for want of a better word. And we have a very strong Senate, certainly, in the Massachusetts legislature on environmental issues, on climate change, on energy conservation, on a whole range of issues that are important to environmentalists. And if we can push, for want of a better word, push is the right way to put it, but at least encourage Governor Baker to become more aggressive and to emphasize the opportunity for him to demonstrate real bipartisan commitment on these very important issues, I think we ought to try to do it.
I really want to hear from you, Emily, because I think one of the big significant changes in the political landscape in New England certainly happened in Maine last night. What can you tell us about the new governor?
Sure. Well, I can tell you a lot of things about what happened last night. First of all, the new governor is Janet Mills, the first female governor of the state of Maine. She's the current attorney general in Maine. She's a Democrat. She has prioritized clean energy and renewable energy throughout her campaign. And in fact, in her acceptance speech last night, it was the second issue that she touched upon. So that is a very positive outcome, particularly following on the heels of the 8 years that Maine has spent under the administration of Governor LePage. In addition to the governor's race, we also have Democrats have claim majorities in both chambers of the legislature, which really lays the groundwork for progress in Maine on clean energy, on climate, on transportation. And, you know, there's one other thing I wanted to mention about the Maine race, which I think was really positive, which is voter turnout. Voter turnout was huge. It was expected to be huge, but it actually surpassed expectations. In some precincts, it apparently rivals the turnout in presidential election years. So the people in Maine are paying attention, and I think this is a significant day for Maine and for New England.
Yeah, and I think that pattern of governors who are progressive on climate and energy with two houses supported was replicated in Connecticut, where even though Ned Lamont was following the most unpopular governor in the country, he was elected, and the Democrats took both houses of the legislature. So there actually may be some reality to Lamont's commitment to have Connecticut be carbon neutral by 2050.
I just want to remind people, I'm sorry, Jamie, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that Emily mentioned the clean energy position that is being solidified up there. And I want to say broadly in among New England, the New England states, I think there's a pretty good consensus on the importance of a clean energy agenda. And it, if we can emphasize the opportunities for jobs and economic benefits associated with wind facilities, with solar, et cetera, I think it provides some opportunity, again, coming back to Massachusetts, to really suggest a partnership, if you will. Partnership, a guy like Governor Baker is someone who emphasizes economic priorities. And so the clean, you know, he's been there on clean energy, but if we can push a little bit harder and emphasize that connection between jobs and clean energy, I think would be a great thing for us to do.
Yeah, and I think that bipartisan coalition in the Northeast, extending all the way to Maryland of governors and Tom Wolf getting reelected in Pennsylvania, governors who recognize the need for climate action in the Northeast, is going to be significant. Because for a while we've had a little bit of a divide between the northern tier New England states, particularly New Hampshire and Maine, and the southern tier, slightly more progressive. I think this new kind of cohort may actually be able to sweep in some of the laggards like Chris Sununu in New Hampshire, who was reelected, but who I think will be facing a lot of pressure, even from his Republican colleagues in other states, to get on the climate agenda.
I just want to remind folks, we really want to hear from you. If you have any questions, if you're on the phones, please get in the queue by hitting *1. And if you're on Facebook, you feel free to type your questions into the comments area. So, Brad and all of you, really, I want to kind of take it state by state and sort of the high-level, races in each state and what happened there. You did touch on Governor Raimondo is coming back as the governor. Do you think that things that have changed in the legislature, what do you think it will mean for her governing this second term?
Oh, I think she'll actually have a very strong position in the second term. The first governor to be elected with an actual majority in Rhode Island in a number of years. And so I think some of her kind of hesitation on environmental issues will be erased as she starts thinking about her legacy, and also she's someone who has national ambitions. I think on the other side of the aisle, I think the same is going to be true for Governor Scott, who, while a pro-business Republican, is the governor of a very progressive state in Vermont and will need to show, I think, some progress on climate. And so I think we have the makings of a very positive climate for getting regional action on things like transportation, which you practically can't do on a state-by-state basis, but where we know the Trump administration is going in the wrong direction. I think that kind of cohesion and collaborative spirit among states and commitment to some of the same principles is going to be really important.
Absolutely. I'd also like to suggest that, there's a broad sort of progressive vibe, if you will, to all the elected officials, really, in New England for the most part, certainly particularly in southern New England, but also, as has been stated, moving forward in that direction as well on the northern tier. Well, with that in mind, if we can put together some coalitions with other progressive-minded groups, if you will, and together push for some of the environmental issues like climate and transportation, being clean transportation, being near the top of the agenda, it might have more impact. I know, for example, CLF has been doing some things in environmental justice communities. Well, I think let's remember that there's a commitment to improving the environmental outcomes in those communities, if you will. And there are a whole set of equity issues that people in those communities are concerned about. If we marry those together and together bring some pressure or at least emphasis on Governor Baker's administration, for example, I think we might, make more progress.
And those communities are often suffer the most from poor infrastructure, lack of mass transit. And on those issues, I think Baker's got to do something. He signaled he's going to do something by creating a commission on the future of transportation. And at the federal level, he actually might get a boost. The one area where the new House of Representatives might find common ground with the Senate and the Trump is on a major infrastructure bill that addresses at least some of these issues.
Good point.
And I'll just add that Janet Mills, while Attorney General for the state of Maine, joined a coalition of states who sued the federal government on a transportation-related issue to try to keep clean car standards and fuel efficiency standards in place. So we're certainly hoping to see progress in the transportation realm up in Maine, expanding access to clean transportation options to people throughout the state, electrifying the transportation sector. And so those are certainly some of the issues we hope will be moving forward in the next 4 years.
Great point. Both Brad and Emily have emphasized the important role that attorney generals have played and hopefully will continue to play. So I think that, perhaps not surprisingly, but I'm encouraged by strong mandates for re-election of attorney generals throughout, and the interest which we ought to support and making polluters, for example, accountable and for bringing lawsuits when it's necessary to move the agenda forward.
I see that we do have some people that are queued up to ask some questions. So we're going to open the phone lines up for questions, and I encourage you, *1, to get in the queue, or you can post your questions on Facebook. Bruce Gellerman.
Campaign, Governor Baker here in Massachusetts suggested that maybe there was something in the making of REGI for vehicles and kind of adapting the regional greenhouse gas initiative to limit carbon emissions from vehicles. What's your sense of that?
Well,
in terms of how the politics played out last night,
I think last night was a big boost to that effort. One of CLF's priorities is to push that effort along really by ensuring that there's a regulatory backstop to it, that we're using our Global Warming Solutions Act to push that effort along and ensure that Massachusetts leads. The Governor Baker has a mandate on the books thanks to a CLF lawsuit. We know that that mandate's enforceable in every sector of the economy, and that's going to give him a powerful incentive to act on transportation, and I think there's a recognition of that, and it's reflected in the fact that he did create that commission on the future of transportation. But I also think it's a very appealing area for the governor to make his mark in terms of a legacy. He inherited, a collapsing T, had a big priority on fixing it. Now, we need to see, what can we get other than, a 90s era T? What should that system look like for the future? How do we move to electrification of regional, of commuter rail, for example, and so that we have in this region a 20th century system and not the system we have now where you could get from Worcester or Springfield to Boston faster in the day of a steam engine than you can right now.
And Brad, just to make sure, go ahead. Jamie,
well, all I was going to say is that, I would reinforce exactly what you're saying, Brad, and I think that since transportation is so high on the minds, first of all, of our residents here in Massachusetts, and and in particular, the failure to adequately serve many of our communities, particularly some of our low-income communities, some of our environmental justice communities, it seems to me that we can join hands with those communities to make sure that when we address those transportation problems, we do it in a clean vehicles way and in a clean, appropriate infrastructure to accomplish it. But,
yeah, that's really important because in terms of Bruce mentioned the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative,
yes,
which I helped start when I was in a different position, but the environmental justice community felt left out. They mm-hmm. felt they weren't at the table for that, that there were some equity implications of it in terms of, their communities being left with the power plants that kept operating. And I think it's important, and one reason we emphasize at CLF the need for a kind of a regulatory sideboard to any kind of market-based system is because we want to make sure those equity concerns are addressed.
That's great. And I know, for example, that other organizations like the Union of Concerned Scientists are similarly putting emphasis on the need for an equity component to these regional solutions.
Emily, we have a specific question for you from Facebook. With Maine Shift, will there be more shared engagement on environmental conservation issues with New Brunswick, Canada, and in general, CLF with Atlantic Canadian provinces?
I think that generally speaking, now that we have a legislature and an executive that are on the same page, that will sort of lend itself to enhanced collaboration with other states and with the governments in Canada. I'm not sure if the questioner is getting at something specific. But.
Well, I would chime in that, as courageous as some politicians can be, they always like company when they take major initiatives. And I think the potential for New England collaboration with the Maritime provinces is really ripe to be pursued. And it's important to CLF as an organization because one of the things we want to make sure is that as we increase, as is going to happen, the imports of hydroelectric energy from Canada, that we're not simply taking away their renewable energy and having them rely more on fossil plants. And so it's really important that coordination takes place. So I think that will be a strong, for both of those reasons, that it will be a strong part of meeting our needs going forward.
Jamie, a question for you. How can Governor Baker from Facebook, thank you, how can Governor Baker increase his credibility on environmental issues in Massachusetts? What should his first priority be for his second term?
Well, certainly in terms of increasing its credibility, it could, I think, join forces with some of the progressive efforts in the Massachusetts Senate, because I think there's been a whole range of proposals in the coming out of the Senate, which don't make it in the House particularly, that would be very helpful in pushing our environmental agenda and addressing climate change matters. Now, again, Governor Baker is, gives good lip service, I think, to all of these issues. I think to actively join with leaders in the Massachusetts Senate who have expressed strong priority on environmental issues and climate change issues would, you know, would enhance his bipartisan, which I've mentioned before, his bipartisan legacy, which he seems to want to have happen. And so I think, you know, joining forces in that regard, I think, would be a useful thing to do. Another very important thing is to make sure that resources get designated for the environmental agencies here in Massachusetts. A lot of us have been concerned that throughout his first term, he really hasn't lived up to what he had indicated he was going to do with respect to an environmental budget. And, you know, part of his legacy is what has he done to strengthen the agencies with regard to enforcement, execution, and putting out aggressive policies.
Yeah, and I might put a finer point on that, which is, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of Governor Baker on these issues, but we have to recognize that most progressive energy bills that have gone through the Senate go to the House to die. And when the Speaker of the, you know, democratically controlled House of Representatives here in Massachusetts isn't putting bills on his desk,
yep,
that move in the right direction, it kind of lets the administration off the hook. And one of the interesting, although not very closely covered, nuances of this election is there was actually a non-binding measure in the Speaker's own district that passed, instructing, again, non-binding, but instructing the Speaker to do more on global warming. I'm optimistic that the Speaker, between that signal, between the fact that some more conservative members in the Massachusetts House were replaced with more progressive members, I think those factors will nudge the House in a more positive direction. I don't think that's going to be a radical change, but I think the other issue you raise is the issue of revenues, which is there has to be, if issues like transportation can be addressed, there has to be the no new revenues, no new taxes mantra has to be reconsidered.
Definitely has to be reconsidered.
I want to get to some of the other questions that we have in the queue here on the phone. Paul Short.
You mentioned, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. So you mentioned the carbon fee initiatives that failed. You know, the 1631 was the one in Washington State. You know, as some of you may know, that would have been not a revenue neutral, would have plowed the money back into clean energy, basically. But besides the point you already made that big oil is obviously willing to spend, you know, tens of millions to fight that kind of thing, what lessons do you think we could draw from that for, say, Massachusetts? Is it a lesson that the citizen initiative has no hope because it'll always outspend us? Is a lesson that we should try it, but make it revenue neutral? Do you have any thoughts?
You know, I think the trend has been toward more revenue neutral measures. I think one of the lessons is it's much harder to do these things by ballot initiative because there's so many policy nuances. And as you probably know, in the state of Washington, this wasn't the first attempt. There was
right.
a prior ballot initiative where the environmental community was divided. Sierra Club on one side, other groups on the other side, for exactly the reason you say, which is they wanted a bigger say in where the money went. And I think that's the kind of issue that the give and take in a legislature may be more suited to than a straight up or down vote on the ballot. But it's definitely a challenge, and I think this local initiative in the Speaker's District may have some influence in pushing things along. I think in New England, what will make a carbon fee happen, what will make Bruce's question earlier about a regional transportation initiative on greenhouse gases, I think it's the fact that if they don't proceed on that track, there's a regulatory mandate that's going to force them to act in ways that are much, much less efficient, much less effective. And I think that's will push us toward that. And I think that law is in place, at least for Massachusetts. That's a big part of the region. We're pushing, CLF is pushing for similar laws in all of our other New England states. As I mentioned, Ned Lamont in Connecticut, reelected on a carbon neutral by 2050 platform. So the momentum and the direction are the right ones. And I think it's going to be, my worry is that people will take away from the Washington State initiative and the similar one that was defeated in Colorado exactly the wrong message, that these are being rejected categorically by voters rather than specifically being rejected on how they're done in terms of where the revenue goes and other details.
I have a question from Facebook for you, Emily. Thank you, Paul. Now that Janet Mills is governor of Maine and Democrats have control of the legislature there, how do you see the state's environmental policies shifting?
Sure. Well, I guess I would like to say, first of all, that I am cautiously optimistic. Of course, we can't know what's going to happen, and various legislators have their own interests and plans. I will say this, though, that many of the legislators from the 128th legislature are back to serve in the 129th legislature and have already shown in the past years their ability to make progress on various environmental and energy fronts, things like solar, and many bills, unfortunately, failed under the LePage administration. They fell to vetoes. And so I think that's a good sign that we have these legislators, we have them back, and we know they're going to be working on things that they've already demonstrated progress on in the past. In terms of specifics, I can tell you what I hope to see up in Maine and what I think a lot of environmentalists are thinking about in Maine, and that includes, as Brad just alluded to, a climate change legislation and a climate change plan. What we would really like to see is something with binding decarbonization targets, something with a regulatory backstop that we can use to enforce, basically that we can use to force action on climate, and that would include some sort of a climate change plan at the state level. We'd also like to see action on transportation, like we've been talking about already. Maine has a lot of rural areas, and Maine needs access to clean transportation options for people in all different communities. That means electrification, that means infrastructure development, that means more transit options. And we'd also like to see progress on the energy front, and that means investments in energy efficiency, investments in renewable energy. We'd like to see fair compensation for people who put solar panels on their roofs. We'd like to see development of offshore wind, and this is also something that Janet Mills has spoken about. So I think there is a lot of room for progress up in Maine, and I'm cautiously very optimistic in light of the rhetoric that now almost Governor Mills has used throughout her campaign.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that, beneath the overall commitments on these issues, there are some really tough questions for rural committees. You've highlighted Maine's rural character. Here in Massachusetts, Governor Baker's opposed a vehicle miles traveled fee for exactly that reason, because of the inequities. And I think there has to be a really engaged dialogue on those issues so that the sort of one-size-fits-all solutions that the environmental community is sometimes accused of bringing forth, so that we're able to respond to some of those concerns. And that's going to take commitment on the part of these administrations, but I think it's also going to take a lot of policy work of the type that you do, Emily, in Maine and throughout the region.
Facebook question here. You touched on it a little bit, but we have a question about what this shift in New England, across New England, means for the push for offshore wind in New England and the Mid-Atlantic, and how might that shift support the regional ocean planning, or will it?
I think actually it's the other way around. Regional ocean planning really set the stage for accelerating offshore wind development, and we're seeing that in the major procurements that Massachusetts has done and will do. I think we're in a competitive posture, really, with other states. New Jersey just made a 300 megawatt commitment, a 3,000 megawatt commitment to offshore wind. The one bright spot is in Maine. CLF has spent the last couple of years battling executive orders by Paul LePage trying to prohibit offshore wind or delay it using his executive authority. We won't be in those battles so much anymore, and we'll be able to move, I think, forward more quickly on offshore wind, because essentially New England could be the Saudi Arabia of wind if we really dedicate the resources and make those commitments.
Do any of you see any issues where we can kind of reach across the aisle? Because I think one thing that we've learned from the past 2 years, it's a very divided country. Where do we have some synergy where we can actually bring parties together on environmental issues? Jamie?
Brad mentioned infrastructure, and it seems to me that what we can do is to be sure that infrastructure proposals and strategies incorporate our commitment to climate change, addressing climate change, commitment to alternative energy sources, commitment to a whole variety of priorities that the environmental community has. So I think that I think there's an opportunity there, and I would like to see us pursue that. And I think the other piece of it is that, and I sort of mentioned this before, joining with other progressively minded constituencies to put forward strategies that incorporate sensitivity to environmental concerns is the way to go, because there are real things that of a progressive nature that we can get behind that aren't necessarily identified as environmental priorities.
I would also add, I think that renewable energy is increasingly a bipartisan issue. Investment in renewable energy grows the economy, it grows jobs, particularly in a state like Maine, where we have the oldest population in the country. Jobs that will keep young people in the state are hugely important. And anyone who's looking simply at economics can see that renewable energies are a great pathway forward. And so I think that's increasingly a bipartisan issue. And we've seen that in our legislature in previous years.
Yeah, and I think it's in some ways one of Trump's great successes has been to divide the jobs-oriented community, the labor-oriented members of Congress from those who are progressives on climate. And, you know, the labor unions, construction trades, they're all for energy efficiency and for renewable energy, because that's where the jobs are. And even in states like Wyoming now, there are more renewable energy jobs than oil and gas jobs. And so I think Emily's spot on in terms of linking the climate crisis with the opportunities, especially here in New England, which is the cradle of innovation, and you have so many of the best and the brightest and the most entrepreneurial working on climate solutions.
Thank you. Some more questions coming in from Facebook, and just want to remind folks on the phone, if you want to get in the queue, please don't hesitate. Hit *1 and we'll get you in the queue. From Facebook, now that the state legislature in New Hampshire has flipped, will we see more environmental leadership there, even though we still have climate denier Chris Sununu as governor? Any of you want to take that one on?
You know, I think there's going to be enormous pressure on Governor Sununu to pivot on climate issues. and I think that's going to come from his Republican colleagues, governors like Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Rick Scott in Vermont, Hogan in Maryland, all of them Republicans, all of them recognizing the need for climate action. I think that coupled with a newly Democratic legislature is going to create a lot of pressure. And I think we've seen that Governor Sununu, when the votes are there, is able to embrace new issues. The CLF worked on a kids' health bill addressing lead poisoning, and the Governor Sununu became its champion, which surprised all of us. But you know, I think we sometimes underestimate the ability of elected officials to move off of ideology. The flip side of that is, you know, some of the a little bit of a cautionary note from this election is some of the most extreme climate deniers were rewarded in this election. Most prominently and disappointingly, Rick Scott, who prohibited the use of the term climate change in Florida agencies, is the new senator from the state of Florida.
Do you think there's any power or where are the opportunities for New England as a delegation to push forward on federal issues? Where are the big opportunities there? Emily, I know you work on a lot of the federal stuff that we're doing here at CLF. Do you see any big opportunities with this leadership and with the change in the House?
Yeah. I mean, I think the regional coalitions that we've already talked about, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative and the transportation initiative that is in development, are really important areas for New England states and other northeastern states to take leadership, certainly. Certainly at the federal level, it's hard to get things done, but the New England states, many of the New England states, have also taken a leadership role in sort of challenging and playing defense against some of the federal actions. As I mentioned earlier, for instance, the Clean Car Standards, many of the New England states have adopted more rigid standards from, they've adopted those of California under the Clean Air Act in order to keep their citizens, to protect them from air pollution and from greenhouse gas emissions. And the New England states have showed their willingness to step up and actually defend those when they've been challenged by the federal government. So those are a couple opportunities.
Yeah, I think what transportation and infrastructure are really going to be the big opportunities. I think, as I mentioned, New England's going to have outsized influence, number one, because of the leadership positions we're having, and we're, knock on wood, very hopeful that Catherine Clark will be in a prominent leadership position, another Massachusetts representative who's vying for a leadership post. But there's another interesting development, which is Representative Seth Moulton from Massachusetts essentially had his own initiative to elect primarily former veterans to House seats across the country. And that effort, his candidates were enormously successful. So he is going to have essentially his own caucus of members, his own voting bloc, if you will, on issues that are important. And I, you know, I think in terms of across the aisle work, infrastructure is, and transportation are going to be the real opportunities. Massachusetts communities, New England, Vermont communities, from Lake Champlain to Narragansett Bay and Long Island Sound, are suffering from toxic algae blooms and the additional water pollution that's coming from a climate impact that's already here, which is this increase in intense rains. That's an infrastructure challenge for those states, and we've seen that toxic algae blooms do not recognize or respect party differences. It's as big a problem for Rick Scott in Florida as it is for Governor Scott in Vermont. So I think that's going to be where the opportunity lies.
Can you dig a little bit deeper, Brad, on Lake Champlain specifically? Because I know toxic algae blooms have been a huge issue there, What is the status of what's going on in terms of that work and what needs to happen?
Well, you know, one of the positives of in Vermont for Lake Champlain is there is actually a pollution plan in place, but It has a number of elements that need funding, that need investments, and in some cases, for example, the communities we're pushing to improve their wastewater treatment, whether it's in Vermont or on Cape Cod or elsewhere, you know, they need the funding available to be able to make those improvements in many cases. And certainly in the case of stormwater, almost every municipality in New England struggles with the additional costs of controlling pollution from stormwater. And I think that's an area where an infrastructure bill could play a big role. And the same is true for transportation. You know, there are enormous needs in terms of transport, and everybody in the public, whether you ride a bus or not, the fact that there are buses, there is mass transit, benefits everybody by keeping the roads less congested, and obviously there's a climate benefit to that as well. So I think those are going to be areas where they may not be defined as climate issues, they may not even be defined as environmental issues, but there are those opportunities for bipartisan work that doesn't have to be identified as climate or environment, but where there could be some unity.
Just a follow-up for you, Jamie. Can you please comment on the opportunity for Massachusetts, the state, and the city of Boston to partner, especially in light of the mayor's recent announcement on a more aggressive approach to carbon neutrality?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, I think this is a great opportunity, at least put it in broad terms. And we've been, I think, blessed, so to speak, with, a sense of priority on climate change and other environmental issues at the part of the mayoral level in Boston. And, you know, I think that I would hope that with his influence that there could be brought to bear some encouragement with members of the Massachusetts legislative delegation, for example, to address in a progressive manner these issues. So I think that the way we ought to encourage the mayor, who has a fair amount of political muscle and has inclinations to be supportive of our agenda, to bring to bear his influence on others in the legislature, particularly in the Massachusetts legislature.
Yeah. One early opportunity there that we're hoping to pursue is really on efficiency standards for buildings. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about transportation, we've talked about air emissions, but we also need to, if cities like Boston are going to be carbon neutral by 2050, we applaud the mayor for making that commitment. It's going to require a lot more aggressive action. And one place where I think there's obvious potential for common ground is working on the building codes.
Mm-hmm.
That's one where we can set a long-term goal. We can make progress over time, and it's a change that will bring about more jobs as those buildings are retrofitted, as they're taken off the gas pipe to get to the mayor's carbon neutral goal.
Excellent point, and I think you know, to partner with labor in that regard, to, you know, for the benefits to flow from a job standpoint.
Absolutely.
I have a question here from Facebook. I want to know about initiatives that you see occurring in Rhode Island.
Well, you know, we have had a mixed relationship with Governor Raimondo in some ways, mm-hmm. primarily because, as has been true in Connecticut, there's been some governors are, even though they're for clean energy, they're also soft on natural gas and investing in new natural gas infrastructure. I think we've seen a shift away from that by Governor Raimondo. I think where we are working in the Rhode Island legislature on putting, as Emily described, putting in place enforceable carbon cap requirements, I think the Raimondo administration is going to be a partner on that. I'm optimistic about that. The Governor Raimondo has taken a hard look at some of the kind of next level challenges we have on climate, and particularly what's not just a climate issue because it comes from fossil fuels, but also a pollution issue, water pollution issue, also an endangered species issue, is plastics. Not long before the election, Governor Raimondo created a new commission to make recommendations on plastics. CLF has our Rhode Island director is on that panel. But it's really kind of a forward-looking initiative that recognizes not only do we need to remove plastics from the waste stream, reduce our waste streams, but that waste stream has a very direct link to climate change because it is the oil and gas industry is really pushing an expansion in the use of plastics so that as vehicles become more efficient, as use of fossil fuels for current uses goes down, they have a new range of products. Mm-hmm. And so we really applaud Governor Raimondo, and we think her reelection will propel those initiatives in Rhode Island and hopefully lead the way not only for neighboring states, but also for the kind of bipartisan partnership we'd like to see, with Rhode Island, between Raimondo and Governor Baker in Massachusetts and Governor Sununu in New Hampshire, hopefully, and Governor Mills. I think that kind of momentum is, we really have a sense of hope about that based on this election.
I have a question for you, Emily, from Facebook. Do you see any opportunities for ocean conservation, specifically marine habitat conservation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those tend to happen less at the state level and more at the national level. Mm-hmm. And so we are certainly working on a variety of things. For instance, we've been talking about offshore wind development. That's critically important to reaching our carbon goals. It's also critically important to make sure that we're siting offshore wind carefully and putting in place restrictions to make sure that we're protecting the wildlife, including the critically endangered right whale. Again, that work's not so much taking place at the state level, but is more of a regional or even national level.
You know, one of the areas where I think the change in the House of Representatives could be very helpful is in creating oversight and investigative work in the House on some of the kind of below the radar screen initiatives, or at least below the radar screen for the general public, where the Trump administration is rolling back protections. And the New England Canyons and Seamounts monument that Obama created to set aside a protected area in the ocean, Trump is now trying to open that up to commercial fishing. There are efforts to roll back other protections. And I think having oversight committees, casting a spotlight on that, bringing it to the public's attention, it may not stop some of these Trump administration initiatives, but it may slow them down, and it may create a reaction both in the House and the Senate among the Republicans on that side, saying, we don't want to deal with these issues again. Mm-hmm. We don't want to face these issues in 2020. So it may have a limiting effect on some of the worst that the Trump administration has threatened.
And the New England delegation has tended to be pretty strong on those issues.
Mm-hmm. Strong, except with an asterisk, I'd say. They tend to yield readily to any complaint from commercial fishing. When just we all want a vibrant commercial fishing industry, but we need that to be a permanent fixture of the New England landscape and not something that suffers in future generations because we haven't managed the resource in a sustainable way.
I think that's a very, very important and good point, because the fishermen can be a noisy group, if you will, that sort of sometimes outweighs the, drowns out, if you will, the legitimate concerns of the environmental community.
We have a question from Facebook that I think is a very interesting one, and I hope all of you can speak to that. How much do you think climate played a role in how people voted in this election? Jamie, I saw a big smile.
hopefully, for those of you in the audience, that was probably an audible sigh.
Not enough, I think. It's going to vary from place to place for sure, but I think in broad terms, I was a bit disappointed not to see, observe. Clear signals that a climate agenda was motivating voters. Excuse me. On the other hand, you know, while it's been a mixed picture, we do have some generally progressive victories, and it seems to me to build on it and have those progressives raise the importance of the climate agenda is, you know, potentially hopeful. It's on us to make sure that those who are progressive-minded put environmental concerns and climate near the top of their progressive agenda, if you will. I mean, they're all, many will give strong sort of lip service to the importance of it, but raising it to near the top of the agenda, I think, is going to be critical.
Yeah, and I agree entirely with what James just said. In Maine, I was pleased to see that the climate change question came up a lot. Certainly not as much as I would have liked to see, and it certainly wasn't prioritized in the way that I think it should be prioritized in today's world. And again, echoing Jamie's words here, I think what's really important is next steps. So we've heard the rhetoric that our new governor has said and that our new legislators have said, and we need to hold them accountable and make sure that they actually sort of put their money where their mouth is and take action on climate, since we've now voted them into office.
And I would agree, and you know, I think there wasn't a strong signal one way. I would argue there's not a strong signal one way or the other, especially when you have Florida facing major hurricanes and then electing Rick Scott as its senator. But I also think the underlying point that Emily made earlier about, you know, this is where the jobs are. This is where the world is going in terms of the world economy and capital flows. I think ultimately those are going to overwhelm some of the shouting from the extremes that unfortunately have really made progress on climate very difficult.
I want to, we're getting close to the end of the hour here and get a few last thoughts. I want to thank everyone who joined us today, either by phone or on Facebook, and for all your thoughtful questions. And, you know, Emily said something about getting involved, and I want to encourage you all to go to www.clf.org and sign up for the email news alerts. This, you know, we got to hit the ground running. Any last thoughts from all of you? Get involved, or just last thoughts on the midterm elections overall?
Well, again, what I would say there, I'd like to emphasize the opportunities rather than you know, some disappointments, if you will. And I think the opportunities, as things have been mentioned before, Brad mentioned the with the Democratic takeover in the House, a real opportunity for oversight to have an impact on some of the disappointing actions on the part of the Trump administration relative to environmental agencies and EPA in particular. We also have from New England some really key congressmen. We have Congressman Neal, who's clearly going to be in a leadership position. We have Congressman McGovern in a leadership position. And it was very interesting the mention of Seth Moulton and the influence that he's likely to have. It's an outsized influence in many ways, given he's a fairly junior member of the congressional delegation, or a newer member of the congressional delegation. But the mobilization of the veterans, and I think, has been an important point, and tend to be viewed maybe as not sort of a more moderate grouping of people in broad terms. So I just think that there's emphasizing the opportunities with respect to the leadership positions that some of our people have. I think it's important.
I would also leave people with sort of a positive spin. I think we made incremental progress at the federal level yesterday, and we also made progress in a lot of states, and the states can get a lot of work done even under the current federal administration, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
I like that. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
No,
it's good.
And whatever else is true, it is much easier to push along a receptive elected official like Janet Mills and Maine, even Charlie Baker, to a position that's supported by science, supported by the public, than it is to be spending our energy fighting a governor like Paul LePage, who is essentially trying to stop progress at every level. So I think that's a wonderful win in terms of the mm-hmm. way the landscape played out
for sure.
Throughout New England, throughout the Northeast, really yesterday. So I think that's enormously positive. I also think this new cohort, we didn't talk much about the generational issues, but you really have a new cohort of members of Congress who I think no matter what are going to bring a different tone.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of the military members, nobody takes climate change more seriously than the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
They recognize mm-hmm. it as a long-term security threat. I think that's going to have an impact. And I also think there's going to be an entire cohort of new members in the House who recognize the importance of science-based, fact-based decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can only get some progress on that, the rest will be easier.
Well, thank you, Brad Campbell. Thank you, Jamie Hoyt. And thank you, Emily Green, for this great discussion. And thank you, everybody who joined today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.